Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for farmers and composters. I'm your host and fellow composter, Jane Murner Senecal. Join me in practical conversation between industry professionals and farmers with a passion for producing high-quality compost. We are going to dig deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production so that we as composters can help enliven the world's soils. In today's episode 6 of The Composter, I get to talk to Dr. Robert Rink. Bob is one of our industry giants. Bob wrote the book On-Farm Composting over 30 years ago. It was the book we used to help set up our compost site many decades ago. Listen to me nervously geek out for the first half of this interview, because Bob is my version of a rock star. We chat about so many things, especially challenges composters are facing with feedstock contamination. There's now a sequel of On-Farm Composting called The Composting Handbook that Bob was editor and lead author for. I highly recommend it. If you are as nerdy as me, you will relish the over 900 pages of compost info. Bob Rink was professor at the State University of New York, where he taught courses on composting, waste management, renewable energy, and agricultural engineering. Earlier in his career, Bob was senior technical editor for BioCycle magazine and executive editor of the peer-reviewed journal Compost Science and Utilization. He is a regular instructor for composting training schools and workshops, nationally and internationally. I thoroughly enjoyed talking with Dr. Robert Rink, and I think you will enjoy the conversation as well. Today's episode of The Composter is brought to you by BioCycle. Founded in 1960, BioCycle is the go-to resource on composting, organics recycling, anaerobic digestion and biogas, end product markets, policies and regulations, and community outreach and education. It's where I go to keep up with composting news. I have learned a tremendous amount by signing up for the BioCycle Connect, the twice-monthly free e-newsletter on BioCycle's website, biocycle.net. I highly recommend checking it out. This episode is also brought to you by ComTech. Today, more than ever, people are discovering the benefits of compost in gardens, landscapes, and agriculture. However, as composting awareness grows, so does consumer demand. As a result, commercial composters are seeking ways to increase year-round production while maintaining high levels of quality in their compost. For many, the solution is a better process. For over 25 years, ComTech has worked with scientists, agriculture experts, and customers to develop a proven four-step process that produces healthy, contaminant-free compost while optimizing commercial production efficiency. This process is known as shred, turn, screen, and separate. You can learn more about the ComTech process at comtechamericas.com/composterpodcast. While you're there, request a complimentary consultation to discover if the ComTech process is right for your commercial operation. On our farm, EarthCare Farm, screening used to be the bottleneck in our process. We now have a ComTech M2 multi-star screener, and it has made our composting process much more efficient. ComTech Americas is proud to support the Composter podcast and is ready to help you make the most of a great opportunity. And now, back to the show. So, Bob, I'm psyched to call you Bob. Tell us a bit about your path. What led you to write On-Farm Composting 30 years ago and this amazing path you've been on for their compost knowledge?
Yeah, it was not necessarily planned. So I suppose the genesis of it is I was a graduate student at Rutgers University in the Agricultural Engineering Department. And I didn't work on composting there, but another group of graduate students did. They had a big composting project, so I got exposed to it while I was a graduate student at Rutgers. And then later, I worked at the University of Massachusetts as an agricultural engineer, and I saw composting as a way to improve manure management in New England states. And there were like-minded people with the state of Massachusetts and in other New England states. And we got together and developed an on-farm composting conference that was held in Amherst, Massachusetts in 1985. I think we planned for, hoped for 50 people to attend, and we got something like 120. And after the conference, I typed out a proceedings from the recorded speeches, and then just kept getting questions and interest. And that led to the idea of developing a handbook about on-farm composting. So I gathered a team of authors, and we published it through a multi-university publishing group known as NRAES, which stood for the Northeast Regional Agricultural Engineering Service.
Kind of like a cooperative extension of sorts.
Yes, yes. And that book just pulled me deeper into the composting world. And while composting was never my day job, it was always a big part of it.
Did you always compost at home?
Did I compost at home?
Yeah, back in the 80s. Yeah.
Always, for a long time, almost forever. My adult life. Yeah.
I believe my dad was at that conference in 1985 or one soon after. He talks highly of the on-farm composting workshop he did with you years ago.
Yeah, I'll bet you he was.
That's really neat. And so what's been going on since then? I know you've been traveling and seeing lots of compost facilities around the world. What's happened since that book came out?
For me?
Yeah, for you.
I sort of made composting my forte, even though it wasn't the entirety of my job. I kept an interest in what was going on in the industry. Continued writing about it and speaking about it. And over the years, from job to job, it just remained a big part of what I did. I suppose the most concentrated time I spent on it was when I was working for BioCycle magazine, which was from 1999 to 2004, I believe. And so I did a lot of different work for BioCycle, from writing monthly magazines to organizing conferences.
BioCycle is such an excellent reference for any of the composters that are listening. That's
it's essential. If you're in the industry, to keep up with what's going on.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. So I think I'm going to skip ahead to say that, like, what you've seen a lot of compost operations now. And can you talk to us about the characteristics of the ones that are really well run?
Yeah, I would say the primary characteristic is that they're run professionally. And they're approached professionally. So it's not any physical characteristics so much as it is the approach that the owners and managers take toward it. They look at it as a business, as an enterprise that requires inputs. And professional inputs that are well done. Starting with financing them. And continuing through whatever engineering is necessary. So good managers are mindful of the regulatory situation they are in. They're mindful of markets for compost and or uses, not always just markets. Some composters, good composters, make compost for their own use. And they watch and they manage and they adjust. So I would say professionalism is a single
characteristic. Awesome.
That defines a good composting operation.
Okay. And kind of on the flip side, what do you notice about the ones that need improvements?
Yeah, the flip side of that, just the opposite. People who take a cavalier approach to composting, treated as an, you know, as an aside to maybe their main business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if some people are in the gravel business and take on composting because they think it's going to make a little extra money, but they don't put the time and the study and the management into it that it deserves as a standalone business.
That's excellent. Those are excellent points. I was looking in the new book that you have, the Composting Handbook. There's a great chart to go through that methodical process of how to set up your site in a way, depending on your viewpoint as a composter. And I think this crowd is into making a high quality compost. So there was one for if you're a site that's really looking for compost sales or compost for your own farm that's really high quality. There was the sort of checklist chart that was to go through. And I really appreciated that little section in there.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. And I guess kind of what defines a high quality compost to you? That would kind of lead into that.
I think more than anything else, I would say a high quality compost is one that's fit for its purpose. So you can make a compost with high nitrogen and a compost with low nutrients, and each one could be considered a high quality compost depending upon the use they're intended for. So the first thing about a high quality compost is it's suitable to the intended purpose,
mm-hmm.
or the purpose that it's sold for. And there are other more general qualities of a high quality compost, including, you know, lack of contamination, maturity. But even things like maturity depend upon its use. So you can have a relatively immature compost that you can use for field applications if, you know, the crop's not going to be planted for a while. Whereas if you're going to use a compost into a potting soil or a garden bed mix, you want that compost to be mature.
I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, no one's brought that up yet, that it's really what it's intended for. Like, we make a high quality compost here that's generally for vegetable production and lawns, but sometimes people will use it for acid loving plants, and it's not what it's intended for. And it doesn't, you know, blueberries don't really thrive in that when they're looking for that low pH kind of, you know, soil medium. So I think that's an excellent point, that there's not like a one defining, you know, parameters for a high quality compost. It's back to your professionalism comment.
Right.
Making it to fit what you're
doing. You can make a compost that has characteristics that are considered to have more value, like something with greater nutrients and that's perhaps more mature, more finely screened. And that would be great if you sold that to many uses generally, but you might be making a product that's more expensive than necessary for some of those uses,
mm-hmm.
for some other uses. So you don't really want to use a high nutrient compost for field application where you're basically looking for higher organic matter. And you certainly wouldn't want to use a high nutrient compost in applications that are intended for soil erosion control.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't want to release those nutrients into the runoff. So fit for purpose is the first criteria of a high quality compost. And then again, as I said, there are some other characteristics like lack of contamination, whether that's chemical contamination or physical contamination, and suitable maturity. Particle size would be another one, but again, that depends on its purpose.
Exactly. Yeah. Where in our country and also in our world do you think there's the biggest need for high quality compost? There's a lot of new composters listening to this that are kind of wondering where to set up their sites.
Where in the world? So are you talking about demand for compost or composting services?
I guess it could go both ways. I was originally thinking demand for compost where soils need it the most. I know for us, we're getting calls from the Midwest, but it doesn't make sense for us to ship out there. But it also could be where there's the most inputs that are, you know, feedstocks that they need to find a home for composting. So I guess it could go both ways.
Right. So let's start there. So I think the place where the greatest need for composters is where there's a move to remove food waste from landfills. So that's where the opportunities are greatest, I think, for composting services. There's a number of states that have legislation that keeps food waste out of the landfill, either presently or in the future. The New England states for sure, New York State, California, probably the Pacific Northwest states, Washington and Oregon, are also on that list. That's where I think there are most opportunities for composters. Places like California and Washington are a little tough at the entry level because of the degree of regulation. But the opportunities to get paid for some feedstocks are there. You would think a place like Florida, which has a long growing season and a high population and strong vegetable production, would have great potential for composters and compost. But for some reason, the politics aren't there for it. And composting and compost use have not been emphasized in Florida. Although it may come. It may come.
Yeah, they're having still a lot of trouble with water pollution with the chemical fertilizer runoff. So it might be time to regulate that into that
absolutely
state.
Yeah. So the potential may be there in the long run. But on paper, it would be a great place for composters too. Find a home. The world, if you're talking about, I think there's lots of opportunity in underdeveloped countries with underdeveloped economies that have a need for nutrients in their agriculture, places in Africa, China. Other Asian countries, India. Africa in particular comes to mind because of the difficulty of importing fertilizers and the need for nutrients and maintaining soil quality.
I went on a trip to Morocco a couple years ago, and I couldn't enjoy the vacation as much as it was a wonderful vacation, but I just kept thinking all I wanted to do was set up a compost operation there. It was just so much sand and that people were burning their food scraps rather than composting them. And I had a language barrier, but I would have loved to have stayed there a little longer and worked on that.
I think there's a great deal of interest in Africa for it and an emphasis on sustainable composting technologies, you know, ones that don't rely on a large equipment and energy, and it could be done.
Totally. Yeah.
I'm actually a fan of decentralized composting, having many compost producers rather than few large ones.
More mimics our ecosystem.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why I encourage on-farm composting, because farms are a great place to produce compost.
Yeah, we need lots of different size composters around.
Yes.
And do you have a favorite style of composting, one that you think most consistently produces a high-quality compost, or I guess fit for its purpose compost?
I don't really have a favorite. I guess my favorite would be, again, this is in keeping with preferring decentralized composting, are simple systems that don't require a lot of upfront investment, and that are relatively small. So technology-wise, methods-wise, you know, I like windrow composting because it is simple, doesn't require engineering. You can basically get into it just by building a pile. And I think windrows that are turned regularly, maybe 6 to 10 times, produce a very consistent compost, both in its physical qualities. The problem with windrow composting is that it's spread out, and it does require some larger equipment. If you're using a windrow turner, it requires that. But I also like basic aerated static pile systems because they're compact, they're well controlled, and they're simple also. They're not terribly expensive, but they really shrink the footprint compared to windrow composting, and that could be a great advantage. It allows composting system to be covered with a roof. It reduces the amount of runoff that you have to deal with. So I'm also a fan of aerated static piles. But the main reason I favor those things is because I prefer simple systems.
I 100% agree. Yeah, less to break. Less to fix. And yeah, nature's, you know, although it's complex, it's pretty simple at the end.
You get to a point where those simple systems can hit a ceiling. Mm-hmm. Because they grow so big, they become more difficult to manage. But that's, I think, part of the what I like about them is you do hit that ceiling, and that'll keep you from getting too big. Mm-hmm. At least you reach that point where you can ask yourself as a composter, should I get larger?
Yeah, I'm asking myself that right now. Yeah, it's great to get to that point and know the footprint of your site and what it can handle. And you know.
But depending on the situation, you know, there are other methods that work. In constrained situations, I like agitated beds for what they do, you know, frequent turning and the ability to aerate and irrigate over a relatively small space. I think rotating drums work really well for getting quick composition in a couple of days that can then later be composted further in a simpler system. So in those situations, they're good methods also.
Yeah, that constraint makes for some creativity and figuring out better systems for sure. Mm-hmm. And what do you see are the biggest challenges composters facing today?
With the growth of food waste composting, contamination rises to the top, physical contamination.
I've seen those the trash separators for compost operations, and like, I just want to do everything I can to avoid getting to a place where we have to purchase something like that.
Yes, and they aren't 100% effective either. They're helpful, but they're not 100% effective. So I think the contamination issue, physical contamination, and also as your question coming up is about chemical contamination, is also raising its ugly head a little bit more. I think we've learn how to at least live with pyridine-type herbicides, but PFAS is something that deserves watching.
Yeah.
Not much to do about it. So that's a challenge. The other challenges are reactionary regulations and odor control still remains. A big challenge.
All really big ones.
Hey, you all, Farmer Jesse here. The goal of No-Till Growers is to help produce and create valuable niche content like what you're listening to now. We create several different podcasts, from the Winter Growers podcast hosted by Clara Coleman to the Collaborative Farming podcast with host Jackson Rolette and many more. We produce videos at the No-Till Growers YouTube channel, including farm tours and crop-specific breakdowns. And our entire model is to create helpful, valuable farming content that is free and open to the public, so anyone, anywhere can use it. So if you appreciate that and our work, or are simply enjoying this show, please consider signing up to be a patron at patreon.com/no-till growers. There are also other support options at no-till growers.com, or you can even purchase a copy of my book, The Living Soil Handbook, because when you purchase it directly from no-till growers.com specifically, the proceeds go to making you more amazing content like this. Okay, that's my spiel. Thanks, you all. Back to the show.
I think we'll go back a little bit to the PFAS and the persistent herbicides for people that aren't quite aware of what those are. Just yesterday in the Boston Globe, there was a story about a facility in Massachusetts where the water around them has been really contaminated with PFAS, and they're now responsible for providing bottled water for all their neighbors and figuring out how to decontaminate the water source. And I know that they're still struggling to figure out where the source of their PFAS came in from in their compost feed stocks, which is super alarming. And then the other thing is, one of the reasons I was asked to do this podcast was there's been so many farms that have bought compost with persistent herbicides, those pyridines, and that have had major growing issues from spreading that compost and not being able to grow, good crops. So those are my biggest concerns for sure. The other things you mentioned are also a challenge, but there could also be that reactionary regulations about these stories, like these PFAS concerns.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm really wondering, how do we handle these things as an industry? Do we have a group that's fighting for us, lobbying for us? Can it really come down to every composter having to buy bottled water for their neighbors? I mean, hopefully is there real safeguards we can have to prevent those feedstocks from coming in?
Well, the group that's lobbying for the industry, at least in the U.S., is the U.S. Composting Council. And they do have a lobbying function and a legislative affairs committee that does try to affect legislation and regulations. They have some information on their website about certainly quite a bit about persistent herbicides and more lately PFAS. The herbicide issue, I'm surprised that you're saying there have been a lot of farms that have been burned by that, because my impression is that that issue has sort of died down. It's something that composters have to now live with, make the best of. It doesn't happen often. Most composters don't have a problem most of the time with it, but it happens often enough that it could create big problems, because when it does happen, it's a catastrophe for the compost users. So the way the industry has primarily dealt with persistent herbicides is to be cognizant of the feedstocks that they're taking in and the sources for them. But perhaps the best way to do it is to test the compost produced by doing a bioassay of that compost, maybe all batches of compost, to make sure that it won't be harmful to particular plants that are susceptible to pyridine herbicides. So it may be that the industry evolves to do a quality control check on either on every batch or, occasional batches as a quality control measure. Just try to grow some peas in it and see if the peas grow well.
Yeah.
If there are no signs of the herbicide damage.
It's for those composters out there, it's a really obvious the peas would grow up really yellow and furled if they did germinate.
Right.
I am seeing that most of the operations that have had trouble with the pyridines they're taking in a lot of manure and bedding. And that might be like the main feedstock. So I know it's Kentucky has had there's been quite a few farms in Kentucky that have struggled with compost from there because there's the horse and cow industry is pretty large there. So almost all the composters are using those as feedstocks.
And that's a really difficult feedstocks to police because it's not the manure and rarely the bedding that the herbicides come with, but what's fed to the horses or cattle. And that's two steps away from the composter and really hard to understand the sources.
Mm. We, in our facility, we do get some bedding and manure from our local zoo, and we do have them fill out a certificate saying the hay they've purchased is free of pyridines. But I'm always, you know, like it would be so easy for a new person to come on staff and that supplier they usually do runs out and they buy from someone else and aren't aware. You know, it's just so many, we're humans. So that's an alarming thing to have to be thinking about all the time. Makes you not want to compost manure and bedding, but it's a beautiful resource if it's done well, you know, if it's a healthy.
It would be sad if we could not.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
It would be sad if we could not. And yeah, and I'm not sure the people who provide the manure actually have a good handle on whether or not pyridines were used in the feeds that were produced. And they may fill out the form anyway. Because they don't know. So I think that the safest bet is to do a quality control check on the compost produced. And if it is found, then limit that compost. That doesn't mean the compost can't be used, but then you limit its uses to applications where the presence of the pyridines won't cause a problem. Mm. Landscaping or especially lawn care, things of that nature.
Do you see any way that we can just get these pyridines off the market? I know that they're there for a reason, but it just seems like it's to have something that doesn't break down through the composting process is just a dangerous setup.
There's been an effort to do that for a long time since they started showing up in the early 2000s. I don't think the Environmental Protection Agency is willing to go down that route because they look at the benefits of the pyridine herbicides to the herbicide users because they're relatively non-toxic. And you don't have to use a lot, and they're effective. Mm. So,
in a short-sighted sort of way,
compared to crop farming, composting industry is relatively small and insignificant. So the EPA sees this as, you know, by banning them, it would do more harm than good. Mm. And it's not just that these herbicides don't break down. They do break down during the composting process. Their concentration will decrease quite a bit. The bigger problem, as I see it, is that they're effective against those target plants at such low concentrations that even if they break down substantially, more than 50%, even more than 90%, there could be enough left over to cause a problem with tomatoes. Hmm. Because they're effective and cause crop damage at the parts per billion level, 10 parts per billion.
I'm always impressed by compost's ability to metabolize so much. It's just alarming when there's something like that can get through.
and again, it does. Composting does metabolize them, but not completely. They're just so effective at low concentrations that you can't get it all.
Mm. And I guess PFAS is like a totally different sort of thing happening. And I know there's starting to be less and less companies using PFAS. But it seems like those really don't break down, from what I'm reading anyway. Have you read differently through that composting process? Yeah.
They break down very slowly. That's my understanding of them.
Yeah.
And they've been around for so long now. They're ubiquitous. So that it's kind of scary. It's sad. So I read the Boston Globe article too. Thank you for providing it to me. So it's sad that the composter in this case is kind of taking the blame for it. I suspect that the source, a lot of that PFAS, if it came from the site primarily, it's because they had been in operation for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and much of that time, PFAS wasn't even in our vocabulary, never mind looking for it in feedstock. So it's hard to point a finger at them for doing something that
wasn't on anybody's radar.
Wasn't a problem, yeah. When they were doing it. I'm still a little suspicious that they're the main source of the PFAS in the groundwater.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Obviously, I don't know the situation. But yeah. I would think I might look for other sources in that area, maybe previous uses of that site. That might be the source. But again, I don't know.
So for a composter like us, what feedstocks have those high concentrations of PFAS? So I can't think of anything. It doesn't seem like it would be in the manure bedding or the food scraps or the fish curry or seaweed or, you know, what would that be coming in with?
Possibly food scraps if there's, depending upon the source of the food scraps. You know, because it's used in tableware, paper tableware, plastic tableware. So possibly some food scraps could have some PFAS in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the source that potentially has the most feedstock is biosolids, because it is the result of waste coming from a lot of different places and being concentrated in one place and treated and then settled out. So I think biosolids is likely the highest risk.
Yeah.
Other than that, it said that it could bioconcentrate in fish, so there might be a possibility that it comes in with some of your feedstocks from seafood waste.
Yeah.
Don't know.
Yeah. Paper pulp seemed like something too, potential contaminant. The paper industry seems to have a bit of it in there.
Depending upon what paper they're making, possibly. Like recycled paper, I would think would be a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Virgin paper, less so.
Yeah.
It's pulp from virgin paper.
I think of it as like that waxy coating on paper plates and,
yes.
You know, I know it's on the carpet things to make them waterproof mattresses and bedding and things, which not much of that should get in through composters, but it does seem to be funneling in there.
Well, the point is that it's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Ubiquitous.
Yeah.
And it's water soluble. So wherever those things are handled and concentrated, whether as a waste or a product, the PFAS could enter the environment.
Yeah.
It's really a consequence of our industrial economy and society. It's been there for a long time. It's been entering the environment for a long time. We're just now becoming aware of it.
Mm.
And so we, as a society, we have ourselves to blame. Certainly not the composters.
Yeah.
They're
getting the blame, though, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. But people should, you know, take a step back and say, well, it's not their fault.
Mm.
It's everybody's fault.
All right. Well, I don't, I, I want to still encourage composters to, especially if you're getting new, don't be discouraged by these kind of things. Just be really aware of your feedstocks coming in, because there's definitely ways to avoid issues. And that kind of feeds into, usually this is when I would ask you what resources you recommend, which I will do, but I really want to give a plug for both books, On Farm Composting and The Composting Handbook, which we refer to here as the Compost Bible. It is, that's the new book that's over 900 pages of just an excellent resource, very detailed. I'm into the 700s right now, so it's been my summer beach read. Yeah, and I want to have my whole team read it too.
Good for you. I'm impressed. You're into the 700s. I don't know if you're aware. There's a webinar going on July 14th, I think at 2 p.m. That's being sponsored by the Compost Research and Education Foundation. About the book.
Oh, great.
I'm going to talk about it and answer people's questions about it if anyone's a little more interested in it. The On-Farm Composting Handbook, you can pretty much say it's been superseded by the Composting Handbook. Mm-hmm. There are some things in the On-Farm Composting Handbook that I would say are absolutely wrong. we know better now. But for the most part, the book's still a decent guide, and it is available online. I think free from Cornell University. So I think if you do an online search for it and put Cornell in it, it'll show up. You get a link to it.
Will that July 14th webinar be available after? Because this probably won't come out till August now. Will that be like?
I think so.
Okay. We'll have to get a link for that. That sounds great.
I think that the Compost Research and Education Foundation, which goes by the acronym CREF, I think CREF will make it available beyond that.
Okay.
It's in their interest to do so.
Yeah, for sure.
They're selling books.
I did watch your webinar on through the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
That's a
great one, and that one was on on-farm composting fundamentals for those of you starting out with composting. It was a really good basis.
Thank you.
There's a lot of great webinars through the Institute of Local Self-Reliance as well.
A great organization, and they have a lot of composting resources on their website as well. Some really good reports and fact sheets. Often a lot of them are issue driven, like something like PFAS, where you can learn a lot of information. So that's a good source of information. As BioCycle continues to be, now it's just online as BioCycle Connects, but it still keeps up with what's going on in the composting industry and waste management in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For anyone interested primarily in community-based composting, there's a book called, I think it's Community Composting Handbook.
Yeah.
That's a good read, and there's a lot of good information. And if you're interested in worm composting, Rhonda Sherman has a book called The Worm Farmer's Handbook. The Composting Handbook does not deal with vermiculture, vermicomposting.
Mm-hmm.
But Rhonda Sherman's book, it concentrates on that. So that's a good resource.
Yeah, I love vermicomposting too. It's all part of that compost ecosystem. We need to have lots of different levels of composting happening all over. It's great. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Is there anything else that you wish I'd asked or that you want to touch upon a little more?
No, I again, in sort of connected to this PFAS issue, like you, I would encourage composters to remain positive. It sounds like there's these big problems out there, but most composters won't face them just by circumstance, but should prepare for them anyway and be aware of them. Again, like the persistent herbicide issue, start doing bioassays to see if it's even remotely a problem. And act professionally, like I said earlier. I think that's the making of a of a good composting site and good quality compost is approach it professionally, not like just a hobby or an aside business.
Excellent advice. I really appreciate your time today, Dr. Robert Wink. Bob.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Jane. I appreciate the time too.
Yeah, wonderful.
Enjoyed it.
Thanks to Dr. Robert Rink for a great conversation. I love his view on decentralized compost ecosystems and simple composting setups. And I definitely recommend the composting handbook. I got mine through the U.S. Compost Council website. Things are now just beginning to unfold with the science and legacy of PFA contamination and persistent herbicides. To keep up to date with the science, I go to the U.S. Composting Council website. They have a tab called Advocacy, and then under that, there's a section on current issues where I follow the sections that I'm interested in. And a huge thank you to Jesse, Jackson, and Michael from No-Till Growers. Without them, this show would not have happened. And check out soulshot.net if you enjoy the music throughout the show. Deep gratitude to all the compost lovers listening out there.